This next item will be especially painful for Gen Xers and even some millennials. Saturday morning cartoons are officially a thing of the past.
That's all, folks.
No, really, that's it. Since the 1990s, TV networks have been pulling the plug on the cartoon block. The CW network had been the only one hanging on until this weekend. Now you'll have to pass down to your children the stories of the good old days, waking at the crack of dawn, pouring yourself a bowl of Frosted Flakes, and waiting anxiously through the commercials to see if Papa Smurf would once again outsmart that wily Gargamel.
He always did, by the way. And now that the Smurf song is stuck in your head, we bid goodbye to the unique institution of Saturday morning cartoons.
And a note of thanks on behalf of all the parents for whom those shows meant a little more sleep on a Saturday morning. So no more Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Goodbye, Care Bears. Goodbye, Gummy Bears.
Gummy Bears, bouncing here and there and everywhere.
Mighty Mouse, we salute you.
Snorks, adieu.
Play along with the Snorks.
Tell us who got you to the TV on Saturday mornings. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, perhaps? Popeye?
Turtle Power, they're the world's most fearsome fighting team.
We're really hip.
Join the conversation on Twitter. We are at NPRATC. You can find me at RachelNPR.
And I'm at RSiegel47.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Hey, the season finale is tonight for FX's The Bridge. This show revolves around two police detectives, one in El Paso and one in Juarez, Mexico, pursuing a Mexican drug cartel. Few people are watching this show. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says that means many people are missing out.
And cut. Cut our ears.
No detail is too small for attention on the set of FX's The Bridge. Standing on a soundstage in Santa Clarita, California, star Demian Bashir is trying to figure out what to do with his shirt during an important scene.
Just lose it and leave it with her.
Bashir says this kind of attention creates an authentic feel that's always been an important part of the show.
We went through a lot of details regarding Mexico and how Mexico works and how we could really get away from certain stereotypes. And that was pretty much what hooked me.
All the dialogue for the scene is in Spanish. Later, it'll be subtitled in English. And while script supervisor Liliana Molina makes sure everything that's filmed matches the script, she also explains the specific accents to the show's producers.
Voy para el trabajo. It's like, voy para el trabajo. Like
drop,
the third
yeah.
letter. Yeah, you drop. Yeah. Because we speak different, kind of like singing.
Yeah.
And then Mexicans, they drop one word.
TV shows are about creating worlds, right?
That's Mauricio Katz, a consulting producer who oversees the Spanish dialogue on The Bridge.
You can't have a series that's completely subtitled, I understand, but when you have people that are like speaking in an accented English pretending to be speaking another language, I think it throws you off.
So the Mexican characters on The Bridge often speak in Spanish, including this moment when Bashir interrogates a man until he makes him cry.
¿Quién te pidió que te llevaras esos cuerpos de la casa? Contéstame. ¿Cómo te metiste en este desmadre?
Bashir says the Spanish language scenes reveal new dimensions to his character, and he believes they have an impact on Latino viewers, too.
We're given those 33 million Hispanics in the U.S., un punto de encuentro, a point where they can actually identify themselves.
To achieve that, Bashir insists on accuracy. He's got family and friends in Juarez, so the star knows how Spanish is spoken there and pushes his fellow actors to adopt the right accent. No one learned that quicker than Ramon Franco, who plays cartel boss Fausto Galvan. As a Puerto Rican from New York City, Franco had no idea how Spanish was spoken in Juarez until his first scene with Bashir.
And he went, no, no, no. He says, it's northern Mexico. It's a different. And I went, but why didn't somebody tell me 3 months ago? I could have had time to prepare it.
Franco's relaxing between scenes in his air-conditioned trailer. He eventually learned the accent, but he found another inspiration for Galvan based on the anger he felt watching news reports about undocumented immigrants captured in police raids. When he tackled scenes showing the crime boss's fury and ruthlessness...
Guess what I did? All of that. All of that anger. All of that power. Right to him. Right to him.
Until I am one.
The Bridge won a Peabody Award for its first season, but it may not get a third act. The show still struggles for an audience, and FX hasn't said yet if it will bring the show back. Still, Franco says The Bridge already has accomplished a lot.
We are blessed to be able to show characters from Mexico that have never been portrayed on American TV. How nice is that?
Given how little the rest of American TV depicts Latino characters, that's very nice indeed. I'm Eric Deggans.
Long ago, The Simpsons won adult audiences over to TV's animated sitcoms. Then came Family Guy, also on the Fox network, a little darker, a little edgier. But for four seasons now, wedged between that bombastic and sarcastic duo has been Bob's Burgers, created by Lauren Bouchard. The Emmy-winning animated sitcom revolves around the life of the Belcher family and their restaurant. The show's oddball characters, their tendency to burst into song, and a dead-on depiction of the pitfalls of puberty have won it a cult following. As the new season kicks off, we talk to Lauren Bouchard about the Belcher family's gentle and wacky dynamic. He says mean stuff just looks out of place in the show's script.
There's a sort of what I call the Archie Bunker urge in creating characters, and I can see it as a trap. That you might want to, say, make your dad character intolerant, and then you could say, well, the son's coming out, he's gay. Isn't that going to be funny? They don't understand each other. But for us, all of us working on the show, I think it ends up being more funny to just assume that they accept each other, the members of this family, and that the conflict comes from elsewhere. Something more circumstantial, you know, Linda wants to go to a thing and Bob doesn't want to go, is funnier to me than one character doesn't fundamentally understand another character.
There are so many great female characters on the show, particularly the sisters, Tina Belcher, voiced by comedian Dan Mintz, a guy, and Louise Belcher, voiced by comedian Kristen Schaal. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of each of these two characters.
Louise is a great example of the sort of precocious child archetype. She is 9. She's the youngest, but we've written her, and Kristen easily plays her as often the sharpest person in the room. She's bored easily as a result and sort of creates her own entertainment in that classic trickster way.
All right, Andy, Ollie, you two and me are the only ones small enough to fit through that hole in the dumpster. I would go, but I'm masterminding this. So one
she's
of you two should
messing with people almost all the time. Tina, her older sister, is a yearning character. She wants. She wears her heart on her sleeve. She's 13, and she's right in the beginning hot zone of puberty. And so she is very focused on a certain amount of fantasy life that involves her and kissing and boys' butts.
I've started writing erotic friend fiction using people at school and zombies.
Oh, do the janitor and the vice principal. I think they'd have beautiful children.
I did, and they don't.
I don't know why. I know it's because of Dan Mintz's voice. And I also kind of lose it every time I hear that character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny. You have actors or stand-up comedians like Dan Mintz. And I know other people who have appeared on the show, Aziz Ansari and Sarah Silverman. And their voices don't change all that much. If I'm being truthful, if I think about what their voices are like, is that part of the draw to these particular actors, or is there something about working with comedians that really allows you some flexibility in this medium?
Both. I love working with comedians. They come to the gig with a practiced and honed ability to make you laugh using just their voice and a microphone. Secondarily, I would say we just try to cast people with interesting voices. Whether they're a stand-up or not, ultimately, you just want a voice that really, you know, cuts and feels really specific. So Aziz, for example.
This town might suck at Halloween, but not if you have this.
I give you the treasure trail.
He doesn't have to change a thing. You just want exactly what he's born with.
The thing about the dialogue on the show is sometimes it feels like improv. Is it?
Yeah, we love improv. Improv is very useful for a couple reasons. One is the actors, when they say something that they're thinking of in the moment, they'll be more alive. You know, I mean, they're all great at reading a script, and they can give you a line read that sounds as fresh as you want, but I still think there's another gear. There's a little extra oomph in a performance when they're thinking of it, and maybe they're trying to make the other actors in the booth laugh. And then, of course, on top of it, we're working with very talented people who can improvise and can often say something funnier that we wouldn't necessarily have thought of in the script stage.
Lauren Brichard, he's the creator of Bob's Burgers. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Audie.
Season 4 of the Showtime drama series Homeland begins Sunday, and it begins with a very significant change. Claire Danes is back as Carrie Matheson, the gifted but troubled CIA agent with a bipolar disorder. But her co-star for the first 3 seasons, Damian Lewis, who played former POW and suspected traitor Nicholas Brody, is not. When we left Homeland, at the end of what ultimately was a disappointing season, Brody and Carrie's dreams to escape politics and run off together had died, along with Brody, who was hanged in Tehran by an angry mob as Carrie watched helplessly. But Carrie was carrying his unborn child. As season 4 of Homeland begins, her baby is still around, but Carrie has found ways most of the time to keep an emotional and physical distance. She's pulled the same trick with her old CIA boss, Saul Berenson, played by Mandy Patinkin. He's now working for a private security firm. They haven't spoken in months. Yet when Saul shows up attending a Pentagon briefing and unable to keep his thoughts to himself, it's clear that Homeland, this many years in, is just like Saul. It still has things to say and ideas to explore, even if they're not always comfortable to absorb.
Actually, I have another thing I was going to mention. Just a thought I want to throw out there.
Okay.
If we'd known in 2001 we were staying in Afghanistan this long, we'd have made some very different choices. Right? Instead, our planning cycles rarely looked more than 12 months ahead. So it hasn't been a 14-year war we've been waging, but a 1-year war, waged 14 times. I think we're walking away with the job half done.
What made the first season of Homeland so distinctive and so compelling was that we had two equally strong characters on very different sides of the story, and we couldn't be sure for quite a while which one deserved our empathy and loyalty more. Season 1 of Homeland, if it had ended with that assassination attempt and its aftermath, could have been a standalone one-season mini-masterpiece of television. But even back when Homeland began, TV wasn't making self-contained one-season dramas, as it's since done so well with Fargo and True Detective. So Homeland kept going, and eventually, last year, lost its way and much of its urgency. But now it's back. The quickly developing central plot this season has Carrie overseeing a so-called surgical strike bombing of a site in Pakistan aimed at a highly placed name on the government's kill list. But thanks to some bad intelligence, the site is a wedding party, and the result is an international embarrassment for the U.S. military. One young man survives the carnage, and his smartphone contains a video showing the wedding festivities at the very moment the bomb goes off. This makes Homeland, once again, the story of twin protagonists who divide our loyalties as we watch. There's the young survivor who has been given all the motivation to become a terrorist, but it may not be in his nature. And there's Carrie, who takes her laser focus and trains it on discovering why things went wrong while alienating almost everyone around her along the way. Even while she's dealing with one of the few people she trusts, Peter Quinn, a black ops assassin with a conscience played by Rupert Friend, Carrie has a way of compartmentalizing that makes her hard to reach.
Can we sit for 10 minutes? You give me the lay of the land.
Sure.
The ambassador's out front with the locals on this, so she's pissed.
Oh, I can't say I blame her. Sandy's intel was good until now. What do you think happened?
No idea. Not even his own case officers know what he's up to half the time.
Lone wolf.
Yeah, leaves the embassy odd hours, doesn't say where to.
Girlfriend?
Maybe, or maybe he's meeting the asset who's feeding him these upper-tier targets.
So who is this asset of his?
Oh, you knew.
Nope.
Well, I have no clue either, so you'll have to ask him.
Well, I will, because I'm the one dropping fire on all these people.
Yeah, well, I know what that's like.
Why?
Checking names off a kill list for a living.
It's a job.
Doesn't bother you? What about when it goes wrong?
It doesn't happen that often.
But it did this time.
I've previewed the first three episodes of the new season. And each of them includes a sequence so intense and so emotionally involving, I leaned forward while watching them. This season 4 plotline doesn't paint Carrie as a good friend, and certainly not as a good mother. But as a spy, when she follows her instincts, she's the best. And Homeland, with an ultra-timely story about terrorism, could shape up again as one of TV's best, too.